Welcome to chapel, everyone. Welcome to the MLK Chapel, and I'd invite you to stand for these next two songs and just worship with me.
There is no one, no one. Thank you and welcome to this very special day and special service. As any student of modern U.S. history knows, 1968 is frequently referenced as a watershed year, and it was indeed a momentous year. Pat and I graduated from Iowa Mennonite School that spring. That's why it was momentous. Anyone who was in high school or college during those years from the mid to the late 1960s, even into the early 70s, remembers those years as tumultuous, full of rancor, protests against the Vietnam War, videos of body bags on the evening news, riots in the streets of almost every large city in the country, including the Democratic National Convention that summer, 1968. One mantra of young adults among many was, "Don't trust anyone over 30. That's hard to believe now, when you're my age, but that's what we said. It was the era of Woodstock, marches on Washington, hippies, psychedelic drugs, and free sex. And just to be very, very clear, some of us did not do all of those things. I think the closest that Pat and I ever came to inhaling was when we went to a Jefferson Airplane concert at the University of Iowa Fieldhouse, and we bought tickets in the nosebleed section so far that we could hardly see the stage through the blue haze. All of us were mesmerized by the oratory of the young preacher from Atlanta, Martin Luther King Jr. We were moved by his calls for racial equality and by his willingness to put himself in harm's way. And he spoke out forcefully against the war in Southeast Asia. And his "I Have a Dream" speech became iconic. And though that dream is not yet fully realized, I find it delightfully poignant that today, the day that we celebrate Dr. King's legacy, we also witness the inauguration of a second term for President Obama on virtually the same site as that famous speech 50 years ago this spring. There are 2 days in the spring of 1968 that stand out in my memory. On April 4, about 2 months before we graduated high school, the news came that Dr. King was brutally assassinated in Memphis. And he was only 39 years old. And then just a few days after we graduated, the country was rocked again by the shooting of Robert F. Kennedy as he was candidating for the presidency. And I remember laying on the floor of my parents' living room, listening to the radio news reports, wondering what kind of world we were entering as high school graduates. And to say that those events have shaped my political views is an understatement. We will, at the end of the service this morning, hear a clip, a video, or an audio clip of "We Shall Overcome." And that takes me back to our high school graduation, where we stood on the stage, linked arms, and sang that song. You can't sing that song without being transported back to those years, and to remember that, in fact, we have not fully realized the dream. This morning, Shane Claiborne joins us for a third time at EMU, I believe. Let me share just a bit about his background. Many of you know him as a much sought-after speaker in many, many circles. He's a best-selling author, prominent Christian activist, and as he describes himself, and all of us can, he is a recovering sinner. With tears and laughter, Shane unveils the tragic messages that we've made of our world and the tangible hope that another world is possible. He graduated from Eastern University, did graduate work at Princeton Seminary. His ministry experience is varied, from a 10-week stint working alongside Mother Teresa in Calcutta to a year spent serving a wealthy mega congregation at Willow Creek Community Church outside Chicago. And I'm just reading the book that was written by one of your close friends now living in Newark, I believe, who was also a part of that group, which is a fascinating book, and his going back to the Roman Catholic tradition from that experience. During the recent war in Iraq, Shane spent 3 weeks in Baghdad with the Iraqi peace team. He's also a founding partner of The Simple Way, a faith community in inner city Philadelphia that has helped to birth and connect radical faith communities around the world. He writes extensively. One of his books is Jesus for President, and I believe you have a chapter in that book called Amish in Charge of Homeland Security. As we say, the dream has not yet been fully realized. Welcome to Shane. Thank you for joining us today, and there will be announcements at the end of his sharing about further activities today. Please join me in welcoming Shane.
I'm delighted to be back at EMU, and especially on this day where we remember Dr. King, and every one of you, I know, is going to go get involved in something today. I was hearing about all the things happening, and it's a beautiful thing to see, you know, tours remembering the legacy of racism, conversations over lunch, even cleaning up that river behind Little Grill, all kinds of stuff. So it's a fun day, and it's curious to me, you know, this week I got all these emails saying, you are going to be at the inauguration in D.C., aren't you? And I said, oops, I got an important engagement in Harrisonburg. But I'm with them in spirit and with you today, and I'm so excited. And this morning I woke up real early to start to read some of the sermons of Dr. King and to get inspired. And I read the Riverside speech and so many of these sermons that we've kind of sugarcoated as we have stamps now with Dr. King. Or I went to Afghanistan this year. I'm going to tell you a little bit about it in a minute. But I noticed as I was getting my visa to Afghanistan, there's a quote in the passport that from Dr. King that says, "We have a great dream in America. It started way back in 1776. And then it doesn't finish that quote, which basically ends up saying we got a long way to go to realize that dream. In fact, the whole rest of the speech called The American Dream is how far we've got to go to live into this dream and the responsibility that comes with the realization that all of us are created equal. So it's a beautiful thing to celebrate Martin King and the dream, but also something to realize that we've got a long way to go. And I thought for the framework of our day, maybe we could think about a story that Martin Luther King talked about. And it's a story that Jesus told of the Good Samaritan. And I think there's a lot of Samaritanism that happens on Martin Luther King Day. Folks going out and doing stuff in neighborhoods. And Dr. King would love that, but I think he would also critique the incompleteness of that if we don't critique the systems that create people getting beat up on the side of the ditch. So I want to read it, even though it's pretty familiar, I'm sure, to some of us, and then we'll allow some things to jump out of at us as we think about this day and this life that it calls us to. So here's a reading from the Gospel of Luke chapter 10. Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, they beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan was coming, and as he traveled, he came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He stopped, and he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey. He took the man to an inn, and he took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after this man,' he said, 'and when I return, I'll reimburse you for any extra expense you have.' Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? So as we think about that, there's a few things that occurred to me as I read it this morning, and one of them is how scandalous this story is, you know, that Jesus is like, I got one for you, right? Guy gets beat up, and the religious folks pass by. One of them's late to a board meeting, you know, and the other, and they go on the other side, and then a Samaritan comes along, and, you know, everybody, I'm sure, would have, when they heard Samaritan, they're like, oh, no, you know, the Samaritans, like, we don't even talk to them. We don't walk through their town. We don't associate with them. They got some whacked out religious views and all that. And yet the Samaritan is the one that has compassion and does something, right? And as we think of that, too, I think of how consistent it is with Jesus, that the heroes are often the unlikely heroes. You know, wherever we think God, this is the hub of everything God is doing in the world, Jesus will challenge that. You know, Jesus' harshest words, like the brood of vipers, were not for wounded people on the fringes of the faith, right? But they were for folks at the center of the religious elite and the authority of religious life that, you know, were self-righteous and heaped heavy burdens on people. Those are the folks that Jesus called a brood of vipers. I'm not sure how you call someone a brood of vipers in love, but I think he managed to, you know. But I think of that. And as you hear the letter from the Birmingham jail today, we remember that Martin King's harshest words were to the pastors and the clergy going, we may not expect the rest of the world to realize that we're brothers and sisters, but at least we could expect it in the church. And of folks that are spending their lives studying what Jesus teaches us. And I think of that old line Jesus said to the religious, the teachers of the law. He said, the tax collectors and the prostitutes are entering the kingdom ahead of you. And we wonder what got him in trouble, right? As Sister Joan Chittister, she says, Jesus is consistently challenging the chosen and including the excluded. So wherever we think God could never be at work, we see the possibility of the Spirit working through even a Samaritan or a pagan king. Or, you know, you read that story of Balaam and God speaks through a donkey. So old Rich Mullins was a singer. He said, so we shouldn't think too highly of ourselves if God should use us. You know, God spoke through to Balaam through his ass, and God's been speaking through asses ever since. But if God should choose to use us, we thank God that God works through all of us. And the other thing that occurs to me as I read that scripture is that one of my friends pointed out that the man in the ditch has been stripped of the two ways that we can identify someone. The clothing on their backs is stripped off, especially in their culture. The ways that you could identify someone were by clothing and language. And so he's knocked unconscious, so no one knows who he is or where he's from. And I think that's the point, right? It doesn't matter. He's a human being that's been beat up and left in the side of the ditch, you know? So do something about it. You don't care the color of the skin. You don't care the language, the religion, or their sexual identity. Someone's been beat up in the ditch, and it causes us to respond. And as I think of that, how easy it is for us to get our routines and our schedules so that we have no space for interruption. And that was the case for these religious folks, wasn't it? That they were passing by, likely on their way to do something meaningful, you know, and yet there was no space for interruption. But when you read the Gospels are filled with interruptions, right? Like almost every story is Jesus was on his way somewhere and then this happened, you know? Somebody pulled on his shirt and someone said, hey, we're having a party. We ran out of wine. Can you help a brother out? You know, and so it's interruption after interruption, you know, and yet that's the very thing that we work out of our life is any space for interruption. We love predictability and schedules and all those iCalendars that sync up and pop up and tell me where I need to be. Thank God, you know, but you think of that, the gospel exists in the cracks. It exists because we respond to suffering. We allow our lives to be interrupted by injustice. And that's, I guess, what how our life started in Philadelphia, really, is that we were college students just like you, and we heard about a crisis in Philadelphia where homeless families were living in an abandoned cathedral, and they were being evicted. And something in us just didn't feel right, you know. And sometimes people ask me, how did you know God wanted you to do this? And I said, I feel like I got drafted. You know, we could not do this. We saw injustice and we thought, well, our exams can wait. You know, we've got to figure this out. So we went down and we responded. I'm not encouraging you to skip your exams. But, you know, like, and that, in some ways, it hijacked our routines. And I'm so glad that it did. And it's that which I want to encourage us to allow space for interruptions, you know, to allow ourselves to see those who are wounded, even if it means we're late to a meeting, to allow injustice to create an urgency in us that we can get sidetracked from time to time to listen to somebody that no one else will listen to. Because that's what, in Matthew 25, isn't it true that, you know, each of those, as Jesus talks about, when you do it to the least of these, you do it unto me. Each of them is a human encounter, right? It's not that you ran great programs or gave great donations. It's that when I was a stranger, did you take me in? When I was sick, did you respond? When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was in prison, did you come visit me? They're personal relationships that I think in all of our talk, maybe one of our great challenges at great places like EMU is we can talk about causes and forget that relationships are at the heart of everything, right? We can talk about injustice. We can join campaigns like Make Poverty History. And those are great things. But, you know, we can never fully make poverty history until we make poverty personal. And I think that this call and Martin Luther King's life were something that made injustice personal. In fact, that's what Dr. King said. We've got to expose injustice so that it becomes so personal and so uncomfortable that people have to respond. That we have to build relationships with those who are most beat up and ostracized and allow their voices to be heard. So Mother Teresa, she said, it's very fashionable to talk about the poor. Unfortunately, it's not as fashionable to talk to them. And if we really care about injustice, then we know those who are victims of injustice by name. We've, you know, gotten our hands dirty in the grit. We're not just trying to change things on Capitol Hill or through the lofty towers of academia, but we're actually realize that the pain is on the street. And the story of Jesus is about a God who left the comforts of heaven and entered in to the pain and the suffering, right? My neighborhood in Philadelphia is called Kensington, and a lot of local folks refer to it as the Badlands. And I say, you got to be careful if you call a place the Badlands, because that's exactly what they said of Nazareth, right? Nothing good could come out of there. But look what showed up, you know? And then, so that, like, God shows up in the pain. God shows up in the struggle. And so when we live near to the pain, like, the issues choose us, right? Like, one of the first things that happened when I moved into Kensington was we had a little 5-year-old girl named Shishi. And she had chronic asthma. And so, you know, for poor folks, if you don't have adequate health care, the place you got to go is the emergency room. Anytime she had an asthma attack, she had to go to the emergency room. And during one of those trips, she died of an asthma attack that was totally treatable. And I thought to myself, like, 5-year-olds don't die of asthma attacks all the time in other neighborhoods. And there's something in us that began to realize that we do want to have the relationships. We want to know those 5-year-olds, but we also want to make sure that 5-year-olds don't die of asthma. And so now we're partnered with this incredible free health clinic around the corner. And I think you got one right here in Harrisonburg. You know, incredible missional doctors and nurses that are providing free health care for folks that can't afford it. We've also started a collective to meet medical bills that was actually started by a bunch of friends of mine, probably a lot of them are Mennonites. And they said, you know, the early church pulled their money together, put their offerings at the apostles' feet and distributed it to folks, so that's what we're going to do. They started doing that, and before long, like there was 20,000 people, and now every month we pull our money together, we meet each other's medical bills, and right now we meet $1 million a year, actually $15 million a year in medical bills in that collective alone. Like, we've done $500 million in bill sharing. So I think that, like, but CNN came and they were like, "We've heard about this bill sharing stuff. Is this the silver bullet to the healthcare crisis?" And one of my friends had a great answer. They said, "There's no silver bullet, but it might be a part of the silver buckshot." If you don't know what that means, talk to me afterwards. But you know that, like, we've all got a responsibility, right, to take care of five-year-olds, to figure out ways that people can meet medical bills, and have laws that ensure that, like, good health care isn't just a privilege that you can afford. It should be available to everybody. So those are all a part of this movement, right? It's this movement that Dr. King was about. And this is a little quote that Dr. King said that I think is so beautiful around this Good Samaritan, that we're called, Dr. King said, on the one hand, we are called to be the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It is not haphazard and superficial. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs to be rethought. And it's that critique, you know, which Dr. King also saw around it consistently. If you read all his later sermons, that this connection between the relationship, what's happening in the neighborhood and what's happening in the world. And Dr. King became so troubled with the violence, because he says in that Riverside speech, "I've told the kids in the ghettos that violence will not solve their problems. But then they ask me, and rightly so, why does our government use massive doses of violence to try to bring the change that it wants in the world?" And Dr. King said, "I knew that I could no longer speak against the violence of the ghettos without also speaking against the violence of my government." And maybe it's no coincidence that his popularity waned, and not long after that he was killed. As he saw these patterns of violence, and the gospel should be the most radical critique in the world. And so I am so excited today, because I think there are movements everywhere of Christians and others that are looking for a world that's free of violence, and that realize that, as Dr. King knew, that hatred cannot drive out hatred and violence cannot drive out violence. And it's that which, you know, in our neighborhood, we're trying to teach alternatives to violence. We're trying to teach kids other ways to resolve conflict. But then we also realize that they're learning this myth in a lot of different places, you know? And it was one day, actually really late at night, that we heard the gunshots fire. And I came out on our steps to find a 19-year-old that was sitting on our steps and had been shot. And the next day he died. And it was that kid, Papito, 19 years old, that humanized the gun violence and the patterns of violence to me. And I began to see that right now, you know, in Philadelphia, we've got almost 300 murders a year, almost one a day. In the U.S., 10,000 a year, right? It was just done a study in Philadelphia that showed a black man is more likely to get killed in Philadelphia than he would be in active service in Afghanistan or Iraq. A world so riddled with violence, crying out, and you think of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem because they didn't know the things that would lead for peace. The witness of the Anabaptists, the Mennonites — I know not all of you are, I'm kind of an honorary Mennonite, you know, but that witness of nonviolence, of courageous commitment to the cross and the enemy love that we see in Jesus. When we see love stare evil in the face on the cross, has everything in the world to say to this broken world we live in. And with that, I think we might have a little surprise. Is that true? I've got some friends that have suffered deeply from the patterns of violence that I got to just visit last month in Afghanistan. And they happen to be on the phone, I think, here. Hey, guys, do you have us on the phone there? We've got them on here, but they can't hear on the overhead. Just a second. We're chiming you in on the audio here. Okay, one more time. We're with you at EMU here. Do you have us? We're connected with you across over here at Eastern Mennonite University with several hundred people gathered on Martin Luther King Day, hungry for the peace that you all are working for there in Kabul. And I think we might be able to hear you. At least I can. And you've got a few hundred people listening. Tell us give us a little greeting from Afghanistan. He's translating, so just a second. We're going to try to get it to where you can hear better. So what really led me to Afghanistan, you guys, was I heard about these young people that had grown so tired of war. They've seen over 30 years of constant war in Afghanistan. 2 million people have died. And these young people, now growing older, some of them have beards and are getting to be more than teenagers, but they started a movement calling for peace in Afghanistan, and they're inviting all of us around the world to be friends without borders, to be their friends. They want 2 million friends from every country in the world, hopefully, that can match the 2 million people that have died. And their motto has become, our love, a little bit of our love, is more powerful than all the weapons in the world. So give these guys one shout from EMU on Martin Luther King Day. So that's a few hundred folks here in Virginia giving you some love. And I know we have technical problems, but we can feel you close to us and know that we are close to you, and we are cheering you on as you continue to build that movement. They were such an inspiration, because as you talk to the older folks, there's such an exhaustion from seeing one war after another, and still hearing the drones build up and the whistle of them coming over, and thinking this thing just keeps morphing and mutating and getting scarier and scarier. And yet these kids, they have a dream that they are not willing to accept the world that they've been handed. And they're looking for friends to build it with. And it's my hope that we can live into the dream that Dr. King said, because he said it should break our hearts that we're sending black folks and white folks thousands of miles away to die together and kill together, and we haven't even been able to sit them in the same schools in this country. And it's that dream that let's not just unite around the dream of America, let's unite around the dream of Jesus. And the dream of Jesus is that we would all be treated with respect and compassion, that we would reach into the ditch even if we don't know who that person is. And we might be surprised when we see who would reach in the ditch to lift us out. So it's that dream as we close that I want to bring in an audio clip that I recorded when I was over there. This is actually from Iraq, but it's the same spirit of these young people. And these kids in Iraq started singing a song, and I recognized it, even though they were singing in Arabic. And And my friend recorded this actually on a little handheld recorder, so it's not too fancy, but it's absolutely magical. So these are the kids in Iraq singing the song that Brother Lauren was talking about, the great civil rights spiritual, We Shall Overcome. So let's listen to that.
نحن نمشي يدا بيد اليوم في قلبي أنا أؤمن نحن نمشي يدا بيد اليوم نحن لسنا خائفين نحن لسنا خائفين نحن لسنا خائفين اليوم
Let's pray together. So God, as we hear those voices, and we sort of hear the voices of the kids in Afghanistan through the wild and craziness of our technologies, we know that they are closer than we might think. And that song, We Shall Overcome, that Dr. King knew so well, seems like that's a part of the groaning of our creation as we hope for and we wait and we work for your kingdom to come on earth. So we pray that we would overcome someday, and that we would overcome today, that we would live into the dream and not wait for the dream to find us. Help us to respond to the urgency of injustice, militarism and violence, gun violence and kids that are getting shot, the subtle violence of racism, cold looks and give us eyes to see your image in every human being. Give us the courage to respond to injustice and to interrupt the patterns of hatred. Thanks for the kids in Afghanistan and Iraq and all over the world that are aching and singing and hungry for your most perfect dream to come on earth. Thanks for Dr. King and for all of the imperfect but wonderful folks that point us towards your way. And above all, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for the cross and the resurrection. May it transform the way that we live in this world. Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Shane, for opening this day of service and learning. And Shane Claiborne will be back here at the same venue at 4:30. And that lecture or forum is sponsored by the Student Lecture Series from our SGA, Student Government Association. In fact, they are the primary funders of bringing Shane to campus. So I'd like the SGA exec to stand for appreciation. If you're here, stand. They were greeters at the door, so you know who they are. Yeah. All right. We immediately after this chapel at Campus Center 203, the Education Department faculty are leading a discussion forum, and we'd encourage any of you who would like to talk about what you heard this morning to go to Campus Center 203. And also, today there's a common reading today. If you haven't yet read Letter from Birmingham Jail, find that and the full schedule of what's happening in this day of service and learning on off the feature link from the EMU homepage or My EMU page. It's worth a read, and it informs then our conversation as well as the input from Shane and from one another. Over lunch today, we have conversations in the campus or in the Pioneer in the cafeteria around the round tables. People from the community are coming in to join too. And then some of us, a lot of us probably, are going to our community place right downtown for a relationship building. There's a chance later today to the only two black businessmen who work downtown have invited EMU campus community folks to what they're saying, come across the bridge. Come to the barbershop of Tyrone Sprague, sixth floor of 2 South Main, and let's talk about oppression and peace building as it relates today, right here in Harrisonburg. We couldn't all go. We should invite them here if we were all showing up, but I hope 20, 25, or 30 of you are doing that. There are tours downtown at 11 o'clock, also a historic tour. Well, one of the tours at 11 is the free clinic and other places like that, providing services for our community, that for the less fortunate, especially for those who are in the ditch. We also have a tour of the historic Newtown. There was a village set up of freed slaves years and years ago, and it's now called Northeast Neighborhood. It was largely African-American community. Now there's a growing Hispanic community there. A tour at 1:30. You can find all of this on the EMU webpage. We hope that you'll participate, not just for this morning's chapel and the 4:30, but throughout the day. So once again, we're grateful for the opportunity to build relationships and to engage through service and learning. Again, thank you, Shane, and let's engage with one another this day and beyond. Thank you. You're dismissed. Oh, I forgot something. Ugh. Oh, as an attempt to save on resources, anyone who wants to carpool for any of these events, meet right in front of the University Commons 15 minutes prior to each event. Specifically, those going to OCP could carpool or ride your bikes or walk 11:45 in front of the Commons. Thank you.